Economists and scientists have begun quantifying some of these damages based on historical events. People have looked at flooding, for example, and quantified the damages there, which end up in the hundreds of billions of dollars.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. So while the climate change news agenda is grabbed by droughts, hurricanes, and wildfires, the inexorable rise in sea level is less easy to see. But it is going to affect billions of people living in coastal regions in our lifetime. So what are the possibilities for and costs of adaptation to the rise in sea level? In our last episode, based on the lectures from the BRED ICG virtual PhD course in environmental economics, I'm talking to Alan Shao of Princeton about the economic consequences of sea level rise. Alan, welcome to Vox Dev Talks.
Hi, Tim. Great to be here.
On current trends, how much is the sea level going to rise?
Well, in terms of our latest projections, we're looking at about a half a meter increase in the global mean sea level under a scenario with 2 degrees Celsius warming by 2100. But these projections are going to go as high as 1 meter in 2100, 3 meters in 2200, and as high as 10 meters, actually, in the year 2300 in the very worst case scenarios. And so what this means is that sea level rise is going to have major economic consequences because about 1 billion people live in low elevation coastal zones today that are directly exposed to rising sea levels, and that number can get bigger as the populations grow.
Whenever we're talking about climate change, there's always some degree of uncertainty. So how certain are we that these sea level rises will occur?
Well, with sea level rise in particular, we actually are fairly certain that the sea level is going to rise and continue to rise, because there's a fundamental problem here, which is that water expands as it heats up, what scientists call thermal expansion. Mm-hmm. And furthermore, there's inertia in this process. The issue is that we're stuck with already a certain amount of sea level rise locked in over the coming years. That is to say that even if we entirely stop emitting carbon today, the Earth will keep warming, the ocean will therefore keep warming and keep expanding. And what that means is that the sea level is going to continue to rise for a period of time. On top of that, ice sheet instability, the sort of polar ice caps, are going to make all of this worse, because as those polar ice caps melt, they are going to add water into the ocean. The uncertainty is much more about how much the sea level will rise. We know it will rise, but we just don't know whether it will rise by 1 meter or much more.
So when this happens, which places are going to be most affected, and what effects will they experience?
So these low elevation coastal zones that we've been talking about, they're going to be directly affected with increased flooding, more frequent flooding, more severe flooding, and even permanent inundation in certain places. On top of that, there's going to be saltwater intrusion as the salty ocean water rises up, and that's going to damage crops, and it's going to take land out of agricultural production. And this is all going to be a massive problem because historically there's been an advantage to settling at the coast, access to trade and so on. And so what that means is that a lot of people live in these coastal zones. And what's also interesting here is that actually the situation is going to be a little bit worse in tropical areas near the equator where many countries have a bit lower income. And the reason for that is first, these tropical areas are warmer and so water warms and expands more. That is to say that that thermal expansion that I talked about is going to be even worse in these equatorial tropical areas. And second, the polar ice caps turn out to be actually very large, large enough to have their own gravitational force that pulls the ocean water a little bit towards the poles. When the ice caps are very large, that's going to benefit these tropical places around the equator because the polar ice caps are effectively pulling some water away from them. as those polar ice caps melt, they get smaller, that gravitational pull away from the equator weakens, and so these tropical places are going to lose that benefit and therefore end up with a little bit more sea level rise in relative terms. And then lastly, also especially severe in these tropical areas, particularly in Southeast Asia, is an issue of land subsidence. This issue of the land itself sinking, often because of things like too much groundwater extraction. And that's effectively accelerating sea level rise in these areas.
This sounds terrifying when you talk about it like this. Do we have any estimate of how much economic damage there may be?
Economists and scientists have begun quantifying some of these damages based on historical events. People have looked at flooding, for example, and quantified the damages there, which end up in the hundreds of billions of dollars. And there's also evidence on natural disasters like tropical cyclones, for example, which are estimated to affect 35% of the global population in severe and major ways. We also have some other studies that have looked at the short and medium run impacts of natural disasters more broadly, including major flood events, for example, at global scale, and looking at how these major flood events have affected populations and economic activity.
So, is there anything we can do? Is there a role for adaptation?
Absolutely. I mean, adaptation is going to be hugely important here. Mm-hmm. It's important for thinking about climate damages in general, I should say, but for sea level rise in particular, adaptation is going to be especially important because sea level rise is a little bit different in the sense that it's going to happen gradually over time in a partially predictable way. And therefore, there's going to be a bit more scope relative to some other climate disasters for adaptation. On top of that, again, looking back at historical events, we also have some evidence on adaptation to coastal disasters in the economics literature. Things like adaptation via adopting flood-tolerant crops, like flood-tolerant rice varieties, for example. Mm-hmm. Things like building infrastructure to allow people to move around as needed. Things like finding reductions in damages when countries and cities experience disasters more frequently. It turns out that there's evidence of adaptation because the damages that these experienced places mm-hmm. are inflicted with is less. And then lastly, there's going to also be some evidence that we already have on how firms respond to this kind of risk, either by themselves moving to safer neighborhoods or shifting towards suppliers that are sort of less exposed to flooding. So that's all thinking about current and historic damages. There's importantly also a strain of the literature that thinks about projecting out future damages. And here, this literature is often going to take dynamic and spatial linkages very seriously, mm-hmm. such that they can capture this scope for adaptation and project it out over the long run. So I mentioned dynamics and space. What are those two bits? Well, the spatial point is that people migrate and goods get traded across space in ways that can respond to sea level rise. We can adapt by moving where economic activity lies. That's a spatial point. There's also this dynamic point. The dynamic point being that these responses can matter as people shift around their economic activity. It can matter for how the overall economy develops because as mm-hmm. people move around, for example, that's going to impact how productivity in the economy evolves, how innovation in the economy evolves, how growth in the economy evolves. And so the key thing here is that both points, the spatial point and the dynamic point, are going to matter for thinking about and quantifying how the economy might adapt as sea level rise starts to and continues to take hold in the world.
As you point out, people and firms will change their behavior. But what about governments? What's the role for policy here?
Government policy here is paramount, and thinking about government policy is paramount, because that policy is going to fundamentally shape damages from and adaptation to these coastal disasters. But what I want to highlight here is that there are going to be some basic trade-offs that governments are going to have to face. There's, again, going back to dynamics in space, there's going to be this dynamic trade-off, first off, because protecting people at the coast is good in the short run. Coastal damages are costly. It's important to protect people where they are. It's important to protect vulnerable people where they are. That's going to be good in the short run. But there's going to be a trade-off here because protection at the coast today is going to encourage that coastal population to continue to grow. And as that coastal population continues to grow, there are going to be more people at risk in harm's way in the long run. And so a sort of short-term benefit, but potentially a long-run cost. That's the dynamic trade-off. Now, there's also a spatial trade-off here because the government ultimately faces a basic question of whether to adapt by encouraging migration away from the coast or adapt in place at the coast. The migration versus the in-place adaptation question. Migrating away is costly, but it's going to eliminate flood risk as people move inland away from the flood-prone coast. In-place adaptation at the coast with a seawall that Jakarta, for example, is entertaining and considering, or buildings that are more flood resistant or government subsidized flood insurance, all of these measures that protect people at the coast and avoid the need to move inland, to migrate away. That's going to be great because these measures are going to avoid the need to pay those costs of migrating away, but they're not going to guarantee safety in a world where this coastal flooding is getting worse and worse each year. So a dynamic spatial trade-off, short run versus long run, in place versus migrating away, governments are going to face these trade-offs at each step of the way.
You mentioned Jakarta a moment ago. I know that you have studied these policy options for Jakarta. Why is Jakarta important and interesting to study?
I think Jakarta is incredibly important when we're talking about the sea level rise kind of policy debate for several reasons. The first is that it's just a massive city. It is the second most populous metropolitan area at a population of 32 million. In fact, actually to overtake Tokyo as number one by 2030 because of the very fast population growth in the city of Jakarta. So it's a large city and it's a city that's especially prone to coastal disasters because by 2050, 25% of the city will be below sea level.
Gosh.
Part of what's happening here is that there's a land subsidence issue, a very severe land subsidence issue connecting to the problem that I mentioned before of too much groundwater extraction and therefore the land starting to sink in the city of Jakarta. And again, this land subsidence is effectively accelerating the rate of sea level rise that Jakarta experiences year on year. So they're dealing with this sort of existential threat coming from rising seas relative to the ground. And in response to that existential threat, the government has proposed a seawall in the most ambitious iteration of this proposal at a cost of up to $40 billion.
Whoa, $40 billion is a huge commitment. How much damage is flooding causing in Jakarta every year?
The flooding is very severe. So it's not surprising that the government is ambitious in its response. The fundamental issue here is that Jakarta occupies a low elevation, low-lying river delta, connecting again to the historic advantage of settling in certain places at the coast in low-lying river deltas where the land is fertile, for example. But what it means is that it has always flooded over the course of the history of the city. And that flooding has gotten worse and worse and is recurrent. Today, we're talking about $300 million per year, and this flooding will only get worse.
I panicked at first as the water started coming in, but we're so used to it. We knew what to do. We moved everything upstairs.
Tens of thousands in Jakarta aren't so lucky. They've been forced out of their homes by the flooding. Entire streets in Jakarta have been submerged, forcing residents to use boats or swim to get around.
I want to note here that the land subsidence is particularly severe because in some northern areas, right at the coast by the ocean in the city of Jakarta, in those northern areas, some of that land subsidence is as bad as 25 centimeters annually.
Wow.
And what that means is that by the year 2050, actually 95% of the northern part of the city, 95% will be below sea level.
So faced with this enormous and very urgent problem, in your research, you've analysed how the government and the developers in the city want different things. What do we assume are their different priorities?
Absolutely. In this paper, what I'm interested in is a moral hazard problem that arises at the coast, fundamentally because the government, for example, needs to bear the public costs of funding and constructing the seawall. But developers don't necessarily internalize that public cost. And so this is the issue. If there is a time inconsistency problem in which ex post, after the developers have developed at the coast, the government cannot resist protecting them because the cost of buildings have been sunk. And now that those buildings are at risk, the government wants to intervene and step in. If the government is time inconsistent and it protects ex post, even though it may not want to ex ante, even though before the buildings get built, it might just be better for everyone to start moving inland. If the government is time inconsistent in this way because of political pressures or lobbying, for example, then what's going to happen is that the developers can in effect force the government to defend that at-risk coastal development at uninternalized cost. And so this is going to be the market failure that leads to suboptimal outcomes in this scenario. That is to say that on top of the typical trade-offs facing government policy that I mentioned before, the short versus long-run trade-off, the migration versus in-place trade-off, there's an additional market failure via the moral hazard, via the time inconsistency, that is also going to distort the outcomes.
So given that, what would be the optimal policy for the government? And, well, this is a real-life example, so what's likely to happen?
What would be best for society is full commitment, regulation by the government, or a commitment to a particular level of defense over time. That would be what achieves the first best, the social optimum. But that's going to face fundamental political frictions. It's fundamentally difficult not to intervene after damages have taken hold. Furthermore, I talk about the government relative to private developers, but there are other ways to interpret the moral hazard issue. I can think, for example, about a current government that has massive incentives to kick the can down the road, to continue to develop the city of Jakarta at the coast, not to deliver the difficult-to-hear warning about risks at the coast in Jakarta, and to inflict the costs of dealing with that risk on a future administration that comes in after them. And furthermore, there is no way for that future administration to tax or regulate the current administration. So a fundamental incompleteness of regulation, a fundamental political friction that is going to lead to a scenario that falls very much short of full commitment, that falls very much short of the social optimum in which there is extended, persistent lock-in at the coast at very high cost to the government in power at the time. And so this is what I'm able to quantify in the paper, but I also give more concrete policy prescriptions that are a bit more realistic than, oh, go and put in full commitment and full regulation. I can entertain measures like partial commitment, commitment to resisting lobbying and regulating at the coast just today, for example, or not today and just tomorrow in a phased-in way. And I can quantify how effective those are at reducing this coastal lock-in moral hazard problem. And I can also think about more indirect measures, like the moving of the political capital away from flood-prone Jakarta to a safer inland city, as is happening right now, or efforts to slow land subsidence in Jakarta by investing in what's called managed aquifer recharge technology. I can think about these other measures and how they interact with the moral hazard problem and quantify the benefits of the government moving in these directions as well.
Jakarta's facing this problem today and in the next couple of decades. But as you said, sea rise is going to be a problem in many, many places. Is this an early warning for other low and middle income countries about the policy decisions that they are going to have to take in the near future?
I think so. I think that Jakarta foreshadows the future and the policy decisions that, in fact, most coastal cities will need to face by the end of the century. This Jakarta case shows that policy faces fundamental trade-offs, and also that political frictions can enter in and lead to suboptimal outcomes. And so I think that Jakarta offers a particular case study that is, in effect, at the frontier of dealing with issues of sea level rise because of its accelerated experience of sea level rise, given its severe land subsidence issue. Jakarta offers us that case study to analyze these policy trade-offs and policy distortions with lessons for other coastal cities globally. There's also a broader point here, which is that it's important to recognize that lower income countries and cities in particular in lower income countries will bear the brunt of climate damages in the years to come. More work on adaptation in these important contexts is absolutely crucial.
As you say, policy choices that are going to have an impact in the short run, but also in the very long run. Alan, thanks for talking about it.
Thank you so much.
Alan's paper is called Sea Level Rise and Urban Adaptation in Jakarta. Also, if you want to view his lecture, download the slides or the reading list, go to theigc.org and follow the instructions there. It's pretty easy to find. This has been a Vox Dev Talk. The best way to make sure you don't miss an episode is to subscribe. Wherever you get your podcasts, you'll find us there. And our past episodes, as ever, are at voxdev.org, where you will also find articles about the papers we feature.